Hey guys, I want to tell you about another Earwolf show you should be listening to. It's the one that started it all, Comedy Bang Bang. It's the show where host Scott Aukerman talks to interesting people. Each week, Scott starts the show by interviewing a celebrity guest, but there's an open door policy, so you never know what kind of odd characters are going to stop by. It's so funny and outrageous, and it's a must listen if you love comedy. So listen and subscribe to Comedy Bang Bang on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Welcome to the Cracked Movie Club. I'm Abe Epperson.
I'm Tom Ryman.
And we're the Cracked Movie Experts. We're here to tell you some neat behind-the-scenes facts about films. Yes. In this episode, we dissect 1995 Strange Days, directed by Kathryn Bigelow.
Yeah, Kathryn
Along
Bigelow
with us...
Month. I said Kathryn Bigelow month.
It will be the end of Kathryn Bigelow month. And next month, we're going to be doing John Carpenter.
What a big hello month. Oh, I see myself.
No, yeah, stay. We need
you're
more
done here. That was our guest, Caitlin Gill. She's a stand-up comedian who's performed for the Flophouse in Viceland and written for Hidden America with Jonah Ray. The series Take My Wife and in the New York Times.
Ooh,
welcome.
I put the nerdy credit last.
I love it. I love the nerd cred.
Although I think any show on CISO is officially comedy nerd credits.
Yeah. Since
I've been on Deep Basic Cable and written for streaming services that are currently being shut down.
Hey-o.
But I did get an opinion piece in our paper of record. Well, in print in the Saturday International Edition, but you can still find it online.
I love that. But anyway, we're here to talk about Strange Days. So before we begin, can you give us a synopsis of the film? Just like two or three sentences, more or less, what you think it's about.
So this is a movie about the near future's hottest drug. This is 1995's terrifying vision of 1999, about the hottest new thing, which is living other people's memories, which are recorded by the person living it at the time. I don't know. It's memory ecstasy. It's a full body experience right. of leaving your body through memory. A hustler dealing in these memory cards who used to be a cop stumbles upon a conspiracy involving old friends, old flames, and he is thrust into a deep web of conspiracy and murder, and he has to figure it out and keep the people he cares about safe.
Amazing.
That's yeah. very just good. Very
sitting here apt. Listening raptly.
Yeah. I am so glad that I read the summary on IMDb and was able to messily paraphrase it for you.
Well, thank you for doing
it's a pretty
that.
Solid one, yeah.
So the reason we ask you to do that is because we do a bit on this podcast where we each give bad short summaries of the movie. So join us on our segment that we like to call Terrible Logline.
We always introduce it by saying bad. I think these are amazing.
I don't.
A man wears an obvious wig for an entire film and it turns out to be a major plot point.
The future of VR is murder and the state police isn't worried about this at all.
They're pretty cool with it. It's about ethics in video game journalism. There's just enough women in peril and men playing with video things for me to say that that is accurate.
It is proto-Gamergate, I guess.
Film predicts almost every aspect of the future with stunning accuracy, except for men's neckties.
From the point of view of 1995, all music is either trance or death metal in the year 2000.
I think in 1995, an accurate logline might have been a near future apocalyptic vision. But updated for 2017, it's just the news. I mean, men who never shower and the women who love them is vague but accurate, I think.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
Perhaps the best encapsulation of this film.
All right, I'm happy.
Everybody's greasy.
Everyone is really greasy, but this was like, that was the time.
Sure.
Like,
kind of,
it was a choice.
Remember
how,
1985's Legend, Tom, is that true?
It's earlier than that, but
it's
earlier
than
that. I think it's 82.
What was Labyrinth?
Labyrinth was 86.
So, like, granted, this is a different time, but like there are trends that like pick up in filmmaking.
Sure.
So the reason I mentioned those two movies is that it became a production designer's like thing that they were like, this is what's in right now, to literally put Vaseline on walls so that like they would catch the glint of light. So when you rewatch Labyrinth or Legend, notice like the you know, the Labyrinth's actual walls. have a very like sparkly look. And the reason why is because it was a trend that they're all like, this is the cool new thing to do. And like every 5 or 6 years, we find out that there's a thing to do in production design or editing or
the
whatever.
The thing to do here was to just forbid Ralph Fiennes from taking a shower.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Nope.
Just grease him up.
You're not showering this whole time.
You were correct, though. Legend was 85.
85.
But I was right about Labyrinth.
Oh, my God. Is that the first on this
podcast?
I think
it is, yes. Yeah.
Everybody,
hey.
Abe finally got a date correct and Tom was wrong. Yes. I'm going to make you feel that he's usually the encyclopedia. So let's dive into the making of the movie. We have a segment we like to call Expensive Pretending. We usually take it from pre-production to post. Take us off, Tom.
Well, this movie was a story conceived by James Cameron that he had started thinking about in the 80s, 1986, the year of Labyrinth. Which is interesting because that's the period of time in which he was still like very interested in tech noir and cyberpunk. And this is before he became obsessed with the sea.
Right. became a sailor.
But he was like, he made like one of like a prototypical.
That's just some white shit. To become obsessed with the sea.
It's yep. true, though. That's all what he's
not,
all about.
Not to send yourself to school to work hard. I know that James Cameron has worked very hard and has been extensive in his studies.
Right.
But it's not like he went as a researcher, as a scientist. So like he just wanted to make a movie that like he used science as an excuse to
that's
make
true.
A movie not once but twice.
That's
that is some
correct.
Expensive pretending.
That's super expensive.
And that is also some I am a pirate shit.
I am a pirate shit.
Yeah, I just don't.
That you just that what you said is a perfect terrible log line for Titanic. Just some white shit.
Yeah,
some
yes.
white shit. What did Bigelow think about this script?
She was interested in it for the aspects of sensationalized crime and like voyeuristic sexual violence as entertainment. Because the time when they were started developing this was around 91, 92, mm-hmm. when she and Jim Cameron sat down to sort of hammer out the story for the film concretely. The Lorena Bobbitt case was big in the news, which is an example of us. Mm-hmm. We had a weird predilection for it in the 90s where any kind of sexual violence related crime we just thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
And couldn't stop watching it. Like this and then, of course, like the Monica Lewinsky stuff and yeah. anything.
It's not just the 90s. Isn't SVU in their like 83rd season?
Right, yeah.
Right. It's a human voyeurism.
Very interested.
Right, human voyeurism. Definitely, yeah.
In making these stories or narratives what we need them to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But at this
and
point,
making them entertainment,
I think
yeah. mm-hmm.
your point being it was like a nexus of this.
Yeah. I think it was the nexus or the first real push in this kind of direction.
Yeah.
It was like where that collided with a 24-hour news cycle.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
then the L.A. riots.
And mm-hmm. then the L.A. riots happened while they were making this, and that influenced heavily a lot of that was injected into this script by Kathryn Bigelow. She was involved in cleanup on the ground after the riots.
Mm-hmm.
And she felt like, well, if we're making a movie about the future of Los Angeles, it would be pretty strange, no pun intended, not to include the LA riots because
right.
very correctly assumed that this is going to be a pretty historical event in as far as the city and,
yeah,
and the
and,
cultural.
Yeah, and if you remember, I think there's an analog for Jericho 1 essentially picking up that
sort of, yeah. Kind of, it's based on the Rodney King traffic stop
right,
in the sense that, not that Rodney King was a huge cultural figure like Jericho 1 is in the film, but it's just the idea, she had a quote that I'm going to try to paraphrase, but it's just the idea that this huge series of events could be kicked off by just a complete randomness. And it's actually a line that made it into the film. I think Tom Sizemore says it in the end. It's just a random traffic stop. And then it turns into, right. you know, obviously the video of that got out and it turned into a riot. Like, you know,
remember when I said it's like the news?
That's
yeah,
just
the
news.
It does yeah. have the, this, it, there are parallels to actual modern events that are
mm-hmm.
Unsettling
yes.
because it shouldn't, like a near future dystopian movie shouldn't be so accurate.
Yeah.
Like it shouldn't have gotten it so spot on. And it's a little early and a little late. It's not like these events,
right.
events like these hadn't been happening since the nation's founding, certainly since the 60s, they'd been exposed on television. Like
mm-hmm.
this was all, it's a logical build, but it is hard to look back 20 years later, 22 years later on this film and realize
right.
like, oh, the news is still the same. And the direct parallel of a random traffic stop cascading into nationwide events that it was just an interesting parallel. It's an interesting time to go back and revisit this movie.
And it's also, yeah. I found the reason that they chose, I think the reason that they didn't do like 2020 or something like that is that there was a feeling at this time about the incoming, like, not Y2K, but the idea of like the year 2000 mm-hmm. having some kind of mystic approach, that it was end of days, kind of like how we had again in like 2012. There was just a part of the population that was just like enough to get a narrative going that it was like, oh, maybe this is like a weird like 2000. And so they chose that intentionally because they were, I think, Bigelow and Cameron are essentially trying to say, the reason we choose the, you know, 2K party is because there's a feeling of, like, the end of the human race.
Yeah, something's turning over. We don't know what the next page looks like in this book.
And so, and that's a very harrowing thing when you say 22 years later, we're still having these issues. I mean, I don't think
The discussion has advanced.
Yes.
Like, I think the response is the thing that's different. Like you said, the events have always been happening.
Right. I mean, I think the theme of recording each other and having access to what we've seen is prescient again, that mm-hmm. these aren't things we would be talking about unless they were recorded and shared.
Right.
So in the same way, the theme of the film that, you know, somebody sees something and manages to record it that they weren't supposed to, and as that information spreads, the consequences grow, mm-hmm. you know, that is something we haven't learned. We find ourselves as humans in these moments, as you know, we've seen play out when we accidentally watch, like, scroll through Facebook and see someone die. Where it's a moment in which somebody responds out of some fear or some kind of terror or some deep seated something bad going on, and you know, shoots a man in his car in front of his child. And the way that ripples out, the impact that has, couldn't be predicted. That's not what the person predicted when they pulled out their gun and fired. They were responding to a small moment, and that moment is so much bigger than small. It's so much bigger than what they were responding to. And I think using that theme of, you know, one person's decision for reasons that have nothing to do with anyone else, mm-hmm. billowing, exploding, growing.
Yeah, there's
it has a sense of being totally out of control. And it's, you know, when you see people, like the images we saw as, or if you were there, participating and marching after that or protesting, it's just so much bigger than that moment. I lost a train of thought in a moment I really wish I hadn't.
I get what you're saying.
I feel like I was moving to something
that
was
going
to fix everything.
Yeah, no,
you're saying I believe they say it in the film. It's not like in the scene where they come on Tick, who's the guy that was kind of selling Lenny stuff. He's dead in his car, more or less. And then Tom Sizemore starts talking about, oh no, I hear the LAPD has these death squads.
Yeah. Right.
And we find out later he's lying because he doesn't want them to take the tape to the police. But the point is, it's like, oh, there wasn't really this overreaching conspiracy. It was just in that one moment,
right,
the bad cop, Vincent D'Onofrio, just got so mad at Jericho One that he shot him. And that was it. One patrolman's decision in a split second. And it causes this huge ripple effect that ends up killing more and more people, and it becomes the consequences become greater the more it spreads out.
And the thing that is so chilling, I found it, is that as you watch this huge response, people in the streets, you know, this uncontrollable outpouring of grief and rage, it feels uncontrollable, and it also feels justified. And that feeling of something being kind of necessarily chaotic, the response to something like that should mm-hmm. be that big, that explosive, that hard to control. It's an interesting atmosphere to put in a movie. It's a terrifying atmosphere to live in, and I wish our president was different, but it's just interesting to watch that now, as that news is very real, that, you know, that action of getting mad at a dude and shooting him has these, you know, effects that should be that big and that chaotic. So the movie has this sense, accelerating from that point, that things are going to get out of control because they should, and there's no way to stop it, and how are you going to kind of keep what you want to have safe? It's not like, yeah, anyway.
No, that's I think well said.
Yeah, I was saying to Abe earlier that in the film, just in light of events that have happened in the past 3 or 4 years, their response almost seems quaint, right? Where they're like, "Oh,
yeah,
you can't have this tape."
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say they were like, "Well, you can't get this tape out. The city's gonna burn. They'll see the smoke from Canada." It's like, no, we've seen In the past 4 years, we've seen dozens of this tape.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the reaction to it has been, obviously, you know, like you can look at Ferguson and see that where it's this chaotic, where people are angry and justifiably so, and the reaction to it should be this outrage that you don't know how to control or process. Mm-hmm. And the other side, you see 100 talking heads on TV being like, well, now what did he do to get the police to shoot him? And like, oh, we don't know all the, you know, and just people endlessly debating what it means and everything. And it didn't have, it wasn't this instant city crumbling revolution. I mean, it has advanced the conversation and, you know, people, but it's like, it seems almost, and just in that moment, it was like, oh, we've seen so many of this.
Yeah, it's almost like 1995 is scared of being 2017.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But you were going on another...
Oh, no, I think we're going to get there. And okay. I'm very curious as to this pre-production stuff, because there's things, I mean, I peeked ahead. Well, right. No spoilers for the listeners, but I got to peek ahead in what we might be discussing coming up here. And I think it's some pretty cool, actually, movie stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
We can talk about the bigger world consequences. I'm sure we will unavoidably get into
that.
Yeah,
we absolutely will.
But what about cameras?
What about cameras?
Oh, yeah.
Shit.
Well, I mean, I thought the financing... film was pretty interesting. You had a point.
It was a part of a two-picture deal between Lightstorm Entertainment, which is James Cameron's production company, and 20th Century Fox, the other movie in that deal being True Lies.
Which I love so much.
It is the polar opposite
it
of this
is
film.
It is the dumbest movie, and I love it to tears.
Oh,
and
it's great.
That's one of my other favorite things about this is I'm jumping ahead a little bit to casting. I want to just throw out like just a maelstrom of names. Of who was considered for Nero.
Maelstrom is the perfect word for
it. It is just all over the place. And we're going to start right off with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Because he obviously was filming True Lies, so he got out of the running. But he was considered to be Nero. Denzel Washington, Michael Keaton, Tom Cruise, Jeff Bridges, Mel Gibson... Bruce Willis, Nicolas Cage, Patrick Swayze, John Travolta, Sean Penn, man. Bill Paxton, Dennis Quaid, Kurt Russell. Oh my God, what a time to be a white male in movies.
Well, Denzel, but yeah.
Well, I guess
Denzel's
right
would have been amazing.
But it's just like the sheer star power.
Yeah, a couple of these choices are obviously bad, but like a couple of them would have been pretty interesting.
But I still would have watched a version of this movie with all of those actors.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, those are all ridiculous, and they would have been so... Nicolas Cage's Strange Days, can you imagine what that would have looked like? Like, his face-off energy, but in this context, would have been just...
This was like right before...
John Travolta.
Oh, man.
Sean Penn. Some of them would have been actually great movies.
Some of them, would have been pretty decent
or surprisingly
films.
Good.
But I thought Ralph Fiennes did a real good
job.
Ralph Fiennes can't do anything bad.
And
he's exquisite.
He's amazing.
Amazing.
It was funny to have my wife walk in and see this. My wife's several years younger than me. She only knows him as Voldemort.
Oh, right.
No concept of his career
That's
before
hilarious.
That. She comes and said, What's going on with him?
What's Voldemort doing?
Oh, you got a movie marathon waiting.
Oh,
you have some really long, intense, emotional
super
movies.
Intense movies.
Yeah.
I think that's so funny that they originally were talking about like Schwarzenegger and stuff because James Cameron wanted somebody specifically, his quote is, glibber and slicker for the role. He completely doesn't understand the tone
of his
own.
I don't think he knew what movie he was making.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing is that it's like Key to Nero that he's like, I don't know. He's like rat-like. He's like an ex-cop, but he's like seedy underbelly. Anytime anyone confronts him with like violence, he's like whoa, 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 whoa. So like to consider people like Bruce Willis or Schwarzenegger or even Patrick Swayze.
Yeah,
like, I can see Swayze doing it, but like Mel Gibson.
But I can see Swayze
like,
doing
there's
it.
There's just too much.
I got a big soft spot for the Swayze.
There's just too much like machismo.
Right,
like, bringing it. And that
Tom
role...
Cruise doesn't back down when somebody's like in his face. He doesn't flinch.
He runs fast
and real silly. Oh God.
I will say that scumbag Tom Cruise is my favorite. Tom Cruise character.
Tom Cruise is only there for an act.
That's true, yeah.
Are you like, talking about like Magnolia or Tropic Thunder?
Like Magnolia, Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah, that's true. Edge of Tomorrow, he does a good job.
Like when he's like a dirtbag.
Yeah.
Edge of Tomorrow is entirely about his redemptive arc, though.
Yeah,
that's true.
They took a movie that's actually about a badass character and made it about Tom Cruise's redemptive arc.
Right.
I liked that movie. It was fun to watch, but
similar to Vanilla.
Should have been about Emily Blunt. But
Vanilla Sky as well. I thought he did a good job in that one. But yeah, he doesn't play a lot of this
It's Jim Cameron just envisioned this like action movie. Sort of like he envisioned an action movie star who would be quippy and glib, but it's like
he wanted an action romance with cool tech,
right?
Cameron's comments on society, you know, he's a blunt instrument. This isn't a person with a scalpel. The Bigelow holds the scalpel.
Yes.
Cameron has a big old club that he whacks you with, and that one club says Avatar and one says Titanic.
He hits you with the club and then he shoves you into the water.
Because the sea.
Pushes you into the ocean.
Because he is the king of the sea.
King of the sea. There was a really interesting quote related to that from Catherine Bigelow where she said as they were developing the movie that she said, quote, Jim's thrust was the romantic element and mine was the harder edge, so it was kind of reverse gender. Like, James Cameron was really obsessed with, like, the romance, I guess. Like, he really wanted to push the stuff between Lenny and Faith.
Titanic in the future.
That's right. Future Titanic! It is kind of like a big boat sinking, Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's a boat.
Follow me, it's a boat. but she was much more interested in the gritty parts and, like, the themes and what it had to say. So she saw Ralph Fiennes is playing the character after she watched him in Schindler's List. Because she was like, that's a conflicted man who has depth. And that's the kind of character I want, because she had a quote. I'm going to read another quote. I have a lot of Bigelow quotes in this because I thought a lot of what she has to say about this movie is really interesting. She said, Mace, who is Angela Bassett, is the film's unblemished hero. Lenny, who is Ralph Fiennes, is an anti-hero. That's interesting in an action context where the heroes are often inarticulate but glib. So again, glib is specifically what she doesn't want in this movie, and that's specifically what Jim Cameron did want.
Right.
It's different to have a hero who invents his feeling and is therefore construed as weak. These are cliches that desperately need subverting. So she wanted to subvert the hero cliche with both of those characters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's done very well in the
movie. Yeah, you're here.
I think.
And I think it's a step ahead that there are ways that this movie is ahead of its time, and the anti-hero being at the center is one of them. I think we forget because the media landscape we're currently in is chock full of complicated heroes, flawed heroes. I mean, I don't know that a 1995 movie was destined to be a blockbuster if it had a conflicted hero. Remember, True Lies was the other movie made in this deal.
Right.
Which is, you know, offers you a much less complex version of human interaction.
A wisecracking dude who just kills indiscriminately, and there's like no consequence to any of the violence in that movie.
Yeah.
And this movie in Strange Days is all about the consequences.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Right. And I
love complete opposite.
I love Bigelow's point about how it needs to be subverted. This idea of like the weakness that Ralph Fiennes, I think, nails is something that is like the vulnerability being weakness. I think that's really
vulnerability,
interesting.
Vulnerability. He's in a spiral.
Yeah, he's not empathetic about himself. He understands that he's kind of a piece of shit, as he thinks. But in the end, he is heroic because of his deeds. Because when the call to action happens, he does
in the end. But
he thinks he does.
Right.
I mean, kind of.
Kind
of. We can dig more into the plot want to move through the plan.
Yeah, I don't know.
You got some thoughts.
I don't know.
Yeah, there you go.
Kind of.
He's a flawed hero.
He's a creepy stalker.
He is a creepy stalker. I mean, the end of the... these thoughts I won't forget. Don't worry.
He's an ex-cop.
That's true.
Like, he'd be less flawed if he was a cop.
Right. Two murderers are cops.
An interesting note on this production is that there was no existing camera system. that could do the point of view sequences.
The squid stuff. Yeah, this is 94, like 20 years before
they
GoPro.
They were looking into mirrors. It had to be kind of handheld to some respect because it had to have the motion of like you looking around, which I also thought was interesting because this is one of the times that Hitchcock famously said that he thought that 50 millimeters, that camera lens, was the one that most appropriately mimicked visual, like human visual. Even though we have a peripheral, and so you could block that off, but it's just like the focal length and just the idea of it feeling natural. He said it was around 50, which is tough to put in small rooms like bathrooms, because that's not like a very wide lens. That's like a middle of the road lens. So they spent a year designing a special camera, and it weighed only 8 pounds when they were done, which is incredible considering, you know, it has to have 35 millimeter magazines in it. And it could fit in the palm of a hand. They put it on a, like a Steadicam rig to make, give the smooth motion of, you know, like, so the operator could, you know, mimic like, oh, I'm looking around. But ultimately it took them a year just to make this camera before they started filming, which is incredible to me. That's a lot of R&D for, you know.
There are so
like
many shots in this film that we would take for granted now. There are, and it's 100%, crazy what it took for them to get them. And when I looked back at the year it was made and sort of stared at it again, and was like, how did you even do this?
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of really cool complicated mirror shots, especially toward the end. Just some really good, well-planned work to make this a film. And in that sense, kudos to the director, because the vision it took to see that through, when you're the shot in your mind when the technology for it doesn't exist and you actually get there and make it, that is pretty darn impressive.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, it is funny that there are parts of this movie that I think are a little flawed, and I'm going to tear into a couple things as we go on, but I wanted to get here because goddamn is this a well-made movie.
Yeah, even like
it's kinetic.
Yeah.
Very much. She's real good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The movement is oddly natural, in the sense where you're dropped into what somebody else experienced is a little bit jarring. Even watching kind of a cruddy crap, like copy on a laptop outside, I was still like, ugh. Like, there were a couple moments where, you know, as somebody straps in or whatever and puts on the head unit that lets you see the memories of others, you know, you're pulled into what they see first, and the way the camera moves and those shots are presented. There's no question about whether or not you're in reality. When the movie started, I was like, is this going to be one of those things where, like, he doesn't know what's real?
I was worried about that.
And as it watches, as you watch it,
strange
no.
Days.
You feel distinctly different when you're watching the memories of someone else.
Right.
And that is a very cool feeling to give. I bet this was fun on the big screen in the 10 big screens it was in.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I bet it was a pretty fun movie to watch.
In fact, Ebert gave it 4 out of 4.
Yeah.
Stars, pointing out the cinematography, as you mentioned, Matthew Leonetti, and the editing by Howard Smith, as perhaps one of the best of that decade. And I don't
certainly
think
he's in
off.
The genre.
Yeah, definitely in the genre.
There's definitely in those sequences, and as you know, movie like somebody who's a pretty big movie fan, like I normally can spot this stuff, but like it was difficult to spot where they like masked cuts in those POV sequences, because they had to, obviously, but they did it in such a way. I mean, they do the, I think in the whips, you know, that's when they would
the
get them,
but
it was still done so well that it was like, I can't tell how they did this.
Yeah.
Like,
it's irresistible to compare it to True Lies just because of the deal. And I know the film has nothing, they don't have anything to do with each other, but watching a film like that, where the special effects are so like, right in your face, like, it exploded, is like how I would sum up the special effects in True Lies. And they're big physical explosions, and that's a cool shot.
It's a nuclear
bomb. So many anonymous wooden boxes that say ammo just blow up, which is cool to watch, but there's nothing visionary about making that. It is difficult to accomplish. It's hard to do right. Of course, it's cool to see it done well, but I don't think there's a lot that's forward-thinking in that. I don't think that's using tools that exist to make a vision that you see, but when you have an idea of what something should look like, and you build you engineer a new camera to make it. That's something a little bit more remarkable, in my opinion. I thought it was very cool.
It's been a through line in a few of her movies, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They had to invent a new camera for Point Break for the foot chase scene.
Yep. And they, in Hurt Locker, used the cameras of actual bomb gear and robots.
That's nuts.
Like, so just like really inventive in terms of like she loves source material. Mm-hmm. It's clear that Bigelow loves it when it's like, how can I be like a fly on the wall of this particular world? Mm-hmm. And so the second that she was, you know, pitched the squid stuff, which is the name of the...
That's what they call the...
That's what they
the
call the, you know...
Viewer little, thingy.
It looks like a squid or yeah. a spider.
It looks like the inside of a bike helmet.
Yeah, exactly.
It looks like you tore off just the... You took off the shell and you just had the little plastic part with strappies.
Yeah.
And then it has a little thing that looks like a mini disc player in the front of it on your forehead.
Right.
And you just whoop, put it on and then you're...
And then so she had to essentially do what we recent years, like Black Mirror, mm-hmm. if you've seen that show, has an episode that's very similar to the plot of this movie. Not the plot in terms of the ex-cop stuff, but
sure.
more of the
The
idea,
James Cameron plot,
the
not
idea
the Catherine Bigelow
of
plot.
Being able to witness, like, not only just the vision, but the nuance mm-hmm. of another person's participation in life. And that is kind of... Like, that's the interesting part of this movie to me. And that's also what I think Bigelow spent a lot of time and
making
the
right.
filmmakers in general.
Oh, if you had made that part of the film badly, it would have
not
been
right.
a film.
So
yeah.
It's a little
the movie
different.
Doesn't work if that
no.
part's not effective.
Yeah. And so your point about True Lies is, you know, pretty salient.
Yeah, again,
in that,
like
I think
you said
that
earlier,
Cameron,
Jim Cameron, blunt instrument.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Explosions. Support for today's show comes from Audible. Audible makes getting more books in your life easy. Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from the leading publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, and business information providers. Unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible you own your books, so you can access them anytime, anywhere, from almost any device, including your iPhone, iPad, Android, Amazon Fire tablets, or Windows Phone. Audible has an unbeatable selection of audiobooks performed with incredible performances. Transform your commute and ride with Audible. Audible's been a pretty great service for me. I've got probably 30 audiobooks and, you know, getting more all the time because you get, you know, credits each month. But I've got both of Patton Oswalt's books, Steve Martin's Born Standing Up, a lot of old Dave Barry books, all the novels by cracked executive editor David Wong. It's a really great service. I super enjoyed it. Can't recommend it enough. It's very affordable and it's very easy. So get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at www.audible.com/movieclub. That's www.audible.com/movieclub, MOVIECLUB, for a free audiobook with your 30-day trial. Hey guys, I want to talk to you about a service called HelloFresh. It's a meal kit delivery service. It makes cooking more fun so you can focus on the whole experience, not just the final plate. Basically, it's a service that delivers a box to your house every week that you can pick from a classic box, a veggie box, and a family box. And you can order 3, 4, or 5 different meals per week designed for either 2 or 4 people. And each of those boxes comes with a bunch of recipes. They're on these really nice-looking laminated cards that have pictures and step-by-step instructions designed to take about 30 minutes for anyone to cook. And that's anyone, even if you are a complete idiot in the kitchen like I am. I tried this the other night. I made a yellow squash flatbread, which is by far the fanciest thing that I have ever prepared. I ruin boxes of macaroni and cheese. Like, that's how terrible I am in the kitchen. But I was able to use one of their recipe cards and just follow the instructions. They make it really, really easy. There's pictures. They tell you exact measurements. It gave me detailed instructions on how exactly to slice the squash. And like, slice it so it looks like little half moons. I'm like, this is language that I understand. It was delicious. It was enough food for, we had the 2-person meal. It was enough food for me and my wife. And it was fun. It was really fun. So for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter MovieClub30. That's HelloFresh.com and enter MovieClub30.
Let's keep talking about production.
Yes. Shot almost entirely at night. There's only like 2 sequences during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's a bitch to shoot an entire movie.
Yeah.
And then shot
in
entirely
Los Angeles.
On location in Los Angeles, yeah. At
that's
night.
Intense.
It's
yeah,
a pain in the ass.
Yeah, that's a lot of lights.
That
and
is...
remember, the cinematographer had to be able to look at, like, multiple... Like, so the thing about lighting at night, especially, but lighting in any... Like, there's places you can't look. They call them, they call it illegal on film sets. Like, look over there. No, that's illegal. Because there's a light stand. They had to light almost everything from, like, a grid that they placed on top that they hid behind like buildings and stuff.
That's so
like
crazy.
All of the street scenes had to be overhead lighting because Bigelow wanted to look everywhere all the time and have multiple cameras going in the chase sequence, like the 30-minute sequence where they're running. Like, it's all... you don't see a light stand. And the reason we don't think about it is because we're trained not to think about that, you know, in movies. But ultimately, that is such a headache for the cinematographer, such a headache.
It's an interesting thing. I've been thinking too much about independent film because I'm poor, but and just making things with what you have. And this is a film where if you got yourself a GoPro, you could make this. Like the camera, the way technology has evolved, we could go ahead and make this movie. That's why I say we take it for granted. This is a movie you could make if you were very ambitious on a tighter budget. But I do think it's interesting that the story is strong enough that if you did that, if you did an indie version of this with your GoPro and your own little rigs, you'd still have a really solid story.
Yeah.
The fact that at the time you had to build technology around it made it a huge budget picture, but there is a really strong story in it that carries kind of the weight of the technology behind it. Another difference between a Bigelow and a Cameron, I don't think Avatar has enough story to not be that pretty.
Right.
You know, I think Strange Days has a different strength in the characters it portrays. It has a different strength in the story it's trying to tell. The story is strong enough to match the cameras they went ahead and spent a year building for it.
Yeah, right.
Big thing is the big party scene at the end was an actual party that they had.
They hired
party planners to plan the event and promote it. All those extras are actual partygoers that had to pay admission to go to that party. And then they had to shut it down a little bit early because 5 people overdosed on ecstasy at the beginning of the hospital.
It was 10,000 people.
God
damn.
Which
is like a crazy amount.
In downtown Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, and they paid $10 to get in. And they had to pay 50 off-duty police officers just to control the crowd, which, as you mentioned,
that's not a lot of police officers.
That's one cop for every 200 people.
Jeez.
So, imagine.
In sequences where you're filming a crowd descending on police officers.
And they're doing drugs, and they paid $10, and they want to get their money's worth.
Yeah, yeah.
$10 in 1995.
I know, right?
That's a lot.
I know.
All those bands they got are like actual bands, like Aphex Twin.
Yeah.
And so they're just playing. They're playing music. They're just playing a show.
Yeah, and they're just recording because it's hard to mimic that. You know, like we talked on this podcast about Christopher Nolan's Interstellar, where they like made money off of all the crops. They like just built farmland. Yeah. And
that's hilarious.
They grew all that corn and then they sold it.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. And this is another way in which they're like...
At a barbecue, this corn was in a movie.
Usually you have
this is famous corn.
Usually you have to pay, like, I believe the going rate at Central Casting is like $87 a day for an extra. Yeah, but in this case, they were like, you pay us
$10. Yeah, that is pretty smart.
And then imagine...
to be in a movie.
10,000 of them.
Ugh.
So
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a lot of money to shoot a party. I mean, it all went back into like the ecstasy.
I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, into the ecstasy. Not paying the cops or like, you know, renting the street or anything.
Right. I'm sure they didn't make money on that party.
In that opening sequence, the squid robbery, we'll call it, when, you know, they're getting chased across the rooftops and the guy that's in front of our POV person leaps across that building gap. That was a real stunt person leaping across a real building gap. 16 feet.
Hey.
So, yeah, they had some dude jump across that gap.
Yeah.
No harness, because he can't be wearing a harness in that shot. I mean, nowadays he would be, and they would just erase it. Because that's unsafe.
Safe. Yeah.
to have this man leap a 16-foot gap.
But he's just like, this is my job.
Yeah.
I was going to complain about my job making me drive to Santa Monica today, but I didn't have to jump over a 16-foot gap to get into the building. Yeah. So
you know,
it wasn't that bad.
You had to watch a bad copy of this movie, though.
I did.
That was your crucible.
Oh, gosh.
This movie had like zero marketing, which is generally a sign that a studio doesn't have any idea what the movie is or how to sell it. Like,
yeah, who is this for is an interesting question when you're watching this movie.
It's such an odd movie. Mm-hmm. Like, we talk about it having a huge budget. It had like a budget of $46 million, which is pretty sizable for a movie of this type at that time, but it's not huge. They had like one CD-ROM that had some music and some behind-the-scenes stuff in an issue of Rolling Stone magazine. But beyond that, I don't remember a single trailer for this film until it was coming out on video. And this is a point, like 1995 is a movie, I mean, it's a year, it's like I was 12, I wasn't like, you know, a toddler, and was watching movies all the fucking time. Like I would watch trailers and be excited for the next movie that was coming out. I do not remember this movie until it was out on video.
Right, yeah.
So
I remember watching it on Blockbuster.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we were like OG pirates.
It's been a few years.
So we like recorded it on another VHS.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. My dad did that too.
Yeah, analog pirate.
So yeah, this movie got no marketing.
Yeah, it really did.
It had a limited release where it was shown in one screen.
That's
which
so
is
weird.
Weird strategy.
Yeah, that.
It was shown on one screen a week. One screen a week before its traditional release, and then it was only in like. Not a lot of theaters, and then it just bombed.
Yeah, it made a little more than a sixth of its $42 million production cost.
Ouch. Yeah.
Which is like as bomby as it gets, unless we're talking about like John Carter or something.
Oh, yeah. Oof. Or 2010's The Wolfman.
And critics also, it was, you know, pretty, you know, bipolarly panned. In terms of some reviewers praised its gritty atmosphere and such, but other criticized it for failing to comment on its violence, which I thought was a unique statement given that, as we were talking about before this morning.
Yeah.
Like, it was a different time back then where, like, I argue that, like, Tarantino hadn't really gotten his hold. Like, if you remember, like, 2000 to 2010... violence was like a thing that most PG-13 R movies just had, and we were just like fine with it. It maybe wasn't as visceral, you know, like obviously in Jurassic Park, Samuel Jackson's arm.
Yeah, there's violence there, but like.
But this is like psychological terror, you know? This got rape, it's got a lot of really.
And the first-person perspective does change the way that feels.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's putting the viewer in the position of being the person committing the act, which is, not a choice every film makes, and it's jarring.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's designed to invoke culpability. Yeah.
I couldn't help but look at what else was around in the movie landscape in 1995. And yeah, I don't know where Strange Days lives in this family. Seven came out, which is definitely a brutally violent film.
Absolutely.
But bad guys are very clear. The hunt is very clear. It's a little bit less messy in terms of who's committing the violence and why. It's a psycho, and he's doing it because he's psycho. It's a pretty simple reason.
Maniac, yeah.
But like Toy Story, Braveheart.
Yeah, Batman
Clueless,
Forever.
Apollo 13, Batman Forever,
Casper.
Waterworld.
Yeah, Waterworld, yeah.
Bad Boys. Like, Leaving Las Vegas is the most challenging film on this list. And when your most challenging film features Nicolas Cage, it's not a challenging year.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing pushing you that
point.
Hard.
It's so weird that it got that. Like, I hate that criticism of it, that it doesn't comment on its violence. I feel like that's all this movie does.
That's what I was getting to, yeah. I think that...
We keep talking about it in... Oh, what did you...
A movie that actually did much better that year was The Net, which is...
Oh, The
like,
Net?
The Idiot's Guide to Strange Guys. Strange Days
is
The Net. It's like the dummy's guide to this movie.
I think The Ref was also that year.
Ref was 93.
Oh, damn it.
Interesting that Desperado came out the same year with that parallel of how this film's story holds up, even though it's a technological wonder house. you can't, you know, not every movie can be Desperado. You can't make them all for $15,000 or whatever.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, that was actually the Mariachi.
Mariachi, you're right. Desperado is much bigger.
Film.
You're right.
But it's the same basic.
I'm not the film nerd. I need you guys.
Yeah, that's fine.
Without you, I say Desperado was the first movie, and it wasn't. It wasn't.
No, Desperado's the one with the spurs on Salma Hayek's leg, right?
Man, yeah.
Jesus, that scene is
That movie is confusing.
Ridiculous.
That scene is hilarious.
It's hilarious.
The whole movie. Anyway.
Can you want to have sex with everyone in the movie and the movie? Is that...
Yes.
It was a very stirring.
Also,
it's a stirring film.
I mean, you remember it also features Steve Buscemi and Quentin Tarantino.
Yes.
Hey, yes. Hey, don't shame my tastes.
Still, that's true, that's notoriously true. Sweaty film.
Oh, very film. Sweaty. Oof, yeah.
Everyone is perpetually
real sweaty and just dirty under their shirt.
Yeah, just like grimy.
The same thing.
Every
yeah.
man's shirt is billowy, and you can tell that he's got a layer of dirt yeah. underneath the shirt.
They all applied dirt before they left the house that yeah. morning.
1985.
Zero showers.
The grimiest year.
The grimiest year. Ugh. Ugh.
It's something that I didn't know until I rewatched it this week. Which is, there's a scene between Mace and Nero about how Nero's, like, wasting his life by selling memories. And Mace says, quote, "This is your life, right here, right now." Which is the sample from that Fatboy Slim song.
Which cracks me up. And
that's
I will never
so
listen to that the
to
same
me.
Way again.
That's all I have for the release, to be honest.
Oh, man, yeah. So,
except that it did put Bigelow in kind of career prison for a minute, well, which is a shame because it didn't deserve
later.
That.
Did. Yeah, it really, like, she was really on, I mean, I lamented at the beginning of this podcast.
The director and the directing was not the problem with this movie.
No.
I think it was just they didn't know how to sell it to people.
Marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Such a, like, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, it was just, you know, I wish she had made more movies. Actually, that might have been before we were recording. This is kind of what really stopped her.
Yeah.
Like, she was pretty, you know, from Blue Steel, Near Dark, Point Break, there's 2-year gaps in between all of them, and this one was like the longest gap. It was like 4 years in between Point Break and this movie. And then she didn't make another studio film for 7 years.
Which is just crazy.
It's
and
like,
that movie was K-19, The Widowmaker, by the way.
Yeah,
which was
the Widowmaker.
Like, yeah, it had Harrison Ford in it, but more or less it's... That also was not like a
it
big...
It was a bomb.
It was, yeah.
But it was like, it's so... It's such a testament to the gender double standard in Hollywood because
yeah.
it's coming right off. This is her follow-up to Point Break, which was a big success for the studio and everyone involved.
Mm-hmm.
Stumbles with this very well-made kind of maybe too... It was just too smart or something.
I think ahead of its time. Yeah.
Stumbles with her follow-up effort to this big and then they just don't she doesn't make another movie for almost a decade.
Yeah,
like, what the hell is that?
Yeah, and James Cameron wrote it, let's not forget that.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, when people talk about this movie now, it tends to get included in his filmography rather than hers,
right?
And
yeah.
and it'll be like people issuing like mea culpas about this film, being like, oh, this is
yep.
a movie that is worth another visit, but it'll get classified as a Cameron
as
film,
a Cameron
much in the
film.
Same way that True Romance gets classified as a Tarantino film.
Once again, that double standard rearing yeah. its teeth. Let's talk about what the film's actually about.
Yeah!
My favorite segment, or details people in the audience
you
may not have
might
noticed.
Not have noticed.
We like to call this segment Hidden Bullshit.
Secret things.
All right, let's talk about some symbolism.
Yeah.
I thought something interesting was that Nero calls himself at one point the Santa Claus of the subconscious. Earlier in the film, if you guys remember at the beginning of the film, when he's driving through the streets, we see two women tackle a man dressed as Santa Claus. I thought that that was interesting because, and this is not Bigelow's words, but she hinted at it in an interview. Nero gives the gift of like pleasing like the basest part of humanity. But in doing so, he's accosted by society itself. In other words, a black market trade like this ought to horrify society. And Bigelow and Cameron are basically saying, in my opinion, humanity is easily consumed by technology and voyeurism. Like, we are the problem. It's not the technology.
No, technology right. is neutral in the movie.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
exactly.
Yeah, technology is really neutral in the movie. And there's
yeah.
no discussion of, well, there is. I guess they made it. The feds made it.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the reason why we have this isn't really explored and doesn't even need to be.
No,
it's yeah. I like that they don't spend a lot of time on that, too. It's just in the first 5 minutes, you're like, here's this technology that exists. So we're like, okay, like, we don't need any more explanation
right.
than that.
I will say your symbolism isn't subtle if you tell me it's 5 days after Christmas and you still got a dude in a Santa Claus suit wandering around. Like, what bender were you on, Santa? When did you lose the reindeer
yeah.
man? That was 5 days ago. You should be off work. Why are you in L.A., buddy? Go somewhere nice.
Go somewhere nice. Don't wear
sleigh was
hot.
Impounded.
Yeah.
All the reindeer are dead.
Another thing that I thought was interesting is that the death that everything like stems from, the woman named Iris. I thought, well, as we all know, an iris of an eye or a camera is the apparatus that opens and closes to allow the aperture of light.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's light in. So the wider it is, the more light is let in. And I think naming the woman whose death leads to the plot, Iris, is basically a nod to how the plot is ignited fired.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, everyone in this film was named by James Cameron.
Yeah.
Everyone in this film. This is not subtle.
I added a note to that because I was specifically looking for that, and I didn't notice the Iris one. But, yeah, you know, and like you said, something Caitlin said earlier about the wider it spreads, the more the consequence, and then the wider the iris opens. But, yeah, like, faith is the thing that Lenny is chasing and trying to recapture. Lenny's name is Nero. Nero burnt Rome to the ground.
Nero's name is also Lenny. Everybody was named by James Cameron.
True, but that's...
It was true at the time.
It was true at the time.
People have since, like, historians have since figured out really
that he
agree,
wasn't
like,
fiddling.
Whether it's there, people that agree or disagree whether or not Nero was actually even in Rome when it caught fire.
Right.
But at the time, definitely what you knew about Nero was that he was crazy to the ground. Yeah. So it's about a guy that's going to burn the city to the ground.
Jericho.
Jericho is the city in the Bible where the Israelites, who were the slaves, killed everybody and took control.
Yeah.
And Jericho One's the name of the rapper who's this trying to move the revolution, the cultural movement.
So I don't know.
Blunt instruments.
No, totally coincidental. Nero's just a cool name.
Can't have people named
so,
Nero.
I mean, Jericho. That sounds like a hit rapper to me.
Oh,
for
yeah.
sure.
Jericho One.
Jericho's a sweet name.
It is a pretty cool name.
Awesome.
But there is nothing accidental about any of that, and it's a blunt. That's...
And then you get like people named Max.
Yeah. Right.
Just gave up. Philo Gantt.
Philo Gantt.
I guess
is he
Philo,
Doe?
Come on. That sounds like a Star Wars character.
Well, I think Philo comes from philia, right? Which is obsession.
Yeah, maybe you're right about that. But I don't know.
I might be giving him
also,
too much credit, but...
It is funny when you have, like, okay, this is a near future movie. This is 1999, which is suggesting
future.
That somewhere, 35... That was pretty good. Like, 40 years ago, some mom named... their child Lenny Nero,
Leonard
somebody
Nero.
Else named their kid. Like, it's just, it's really reaching back. The names suggest a farther history. Like, the names are just funny to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're ridiculous. So what do you guys think this movie's actually about?
I think it's, you know, it's about I think it's about partially the difference between white and black culture in America, or at least the white and black experience. In America, because all the white people are the people who are addicted to the viewing. They're the people who are sitting in the towers, they have nothing more to gain, so they're just kind of like going to seed, living other people's lives.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are generally terrified of Y2K because of what it represents. Like, oh, it could be the end of everything.
Right.
And that's like the redistribution of power. Because like in many I mean, it's very coded. It's not like a literal, because I mean, you can come at anything and be like, oh, well, it's not all white people. But let's mean like, yeah, the positions of power, the way the power hierarchy works in this country
it's
white
people.
And then the black characters like Jericho, who's this revolutionary mouthpiece leader for the black community. And then you have Mace, who is vehemently against anything to do with Squidge. He gets pissed at Lenny for even bringing it out in her car. And she really doesn't want to watch the tape. And she's the one that has to drag him out and be like, this is real fucking life.
Yeah.
Like,
and she's the one who has to take the risk to give the disc to...
Yeah.
Like, she has to be the conduit between light and dark. She has to go between the two worlds. You know, if you have Lenny as a character in the underworld who's trying to do good, and then you have, you know, the police chief who's theoretically on the right side, but things are corrupt there.
Right.
You know, the... good things coming from the bad side have to find somebody good on the other side. And she has to kind of be the bridge, which is a tough position to be in.
Yeah.
But then it's like I said, all the race is codified, and it's sort of like she has to do that. She has to take the harm aspect of it, like the physical harm, like the way that Jericho did. And because, you know, Jericho's murder is what's exposing this. The LAPD corruption, and then she in turn has to get beaten basically in a crowd of people in order to be heard.
That scene is uncomfortable, and it's a criticism with Detroit that I read that I think is honest and accurate, that Bigelow depicts state violence against black people with a filmmaker's removal, and there is something... She doesn't do that with white women in Fear. And I'll hold that comment because there's something to come back around to where those depictions are very interesting to me. But there's this step behind where she is presenting it as a statement, as a an allegory, that violence. But the actual depiction of it, as I've read from people of color watching those films, it lacks something personal, and that makes it traumatic. It makes it viscerally very hard to watch. And I think that's accurate. I think there is a level of removal or a way she's viewing these circumstances academically that reflects in the filmmaking that makes it a little uncomfortable for me. You just watch this woman get the shit kicked out of her. It's just a baton swinging at a woman's head over and over again.
Like four.
And Bigelow's making a statement. Look at what our society's doing. Look at this bigger picture. But the small picture is horrifying. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something, as a filmmaker and a storyteller, that's how she experiences the world. I think it's honest. And she makes great films. So you can go in and analyze this stuff. But I really respect anybody who has that response of like, I can't look at that the way she does. There's a level of removal that you do not see in her depictions of white women being afraid. So often when men depict women feeling fear, the characters comes off as reflecting this like, oh, this fear is unusual. Things are supposed to feel safe, and I suddenly feel unsafe, looking for something new in the environment. What could possibly be making me feel this strange way? Whereas when Bigelow puts the camera on in front of a woman who's feeling fear, that fear is understandable. The woman isn't afraid of the fear. She is possessed of it. This is something she's experienced. It should be there. It's normal for her to feel that fear. There's just a few times when it has some in this movie where something very typical happens. A woman in high heels runs away from danger. But you can feel a different perspective from that character when, I would say, a woman, but I'll be specific, when this woman is behind the camera directing that actor, directing that action. There's a much more natural feeling to why these women are afraid. It's not the same as True Lies. Ah, I'm hanging from a plane. It's like the fear is real. The feel that fear is normal. You should feel that fear.
Yeah.
She's so good at that from a white woman's perspective, which we can see in her movies.
Right.
But I still think that when she's making a larger comment about race, you know, her own perspective means she can only make a larger comment. And these are very specific moments she's depicting, and they are hard to watch.
I think that's well said, because we also we had the same kind of thought when we talked about Zero Dark Thirty with Teresa, is that the depiction of Jessica Chastain's character in that, Maya, she is almost fearless, and at the like she propels everything forward, yet at the same time has very concrete moments of like asking herself if this is the right way to be that, which is a lot more complex than most main characters.
And most main characters in an action movie about United States military against brown enemies.
And she, you know, like there's that one scene, multiple scenes, it's the montage where she's writing the number on the board and she just like is staring at her quote unquote superior and just be like, who's culpable for this? Like, what? I'm the one who's making sure this is going to happen. And she's like very fearless, but in a way that you know that there's several moments in the film that she has very, very real fear.
Her view on institutional life is interesting.
Yeah.
And the individuals stuck in it. I think she has kind of a noble soldier complex, which I understand because I feel that way myself sometimes, where there's so much admiration for the individual story, but the larger picture is so fucked up and I hate it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you take a character like that, Jessica Chastain's character in Zero Dark Thirty, flawed, broken, questioning herself, but driving forward for something she hopes is right, and the institution around her, there's no doing anything right. There's no doing any good.
And that's Angela Bassett in this movie.
Yes.
We see that she, you know, we see the scene where she meets Lenny is some unclear crime has taken place at her house. And so she's rushing inside to see if her child is safe. And then Lenny's sitting there because he was a police officer at the time, sitting with her child. So we see that she's come from this place where.
And she actually is wearing waitresses, a diner's.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So she, like, is this archetypal, like, female, like.
Single mother. We know she's.
Maiden.
Becoming a single mother.
Right.
Damsel in distress kind of deal.
Sort of. But it's. I think it's. Definitely.
I think that's what she's trying to miss. She's like, what's the most archetypal? Like, what would Tarantino think is, like, the sexiest woman?
Right.
And then let's fuck with that.
Right.
Angela Bassett in a waitress outfit is probably exactly that.
Yeah.
With Uma Thurman's feet somehow. And then you got the perfect woman. And I wouldn't argue with them. I think that's right.
Oh, she's great. Feet. Angela Bassett's great in this movie.
Dude, Uma's feet in Kill Bill. Very stirring. Another very confusing movie.
We'll
I didn't date a woman
Tarantino.
Until I was 32. So it took me a while to figure out what I was feeling in movies like Kill Bill.
But yeah, I mentioned that scene because she's showing that she comes with sort of what you were saying, this system or this institution where it's like she lives in a world where she has to be at work and worry about whether or not her child is safe.
Well, she mentions that once and then proceeds to stay out all night. Okay, so right, here's where I can get in.
Yeah.
Now we're dipping back in. There's no fucking hero in this movie, and she's kind of an idiot. Like, what are you doing? So a cop guy is nice to your kid while arresting your husband. You wind up having some kind of weird relationship with him. He leaves you for a girl who hustles blowjobs for crack but has a beautiful voice, falls madly in love with her, records himself fucking her multiple times, watches those videos after she leaves him for a sleazier guy. He falls in love with a woman who is cruel to him, leaves him, and winds up getting him entangled in a horrible mess that she is then drawn into. And still, Angela Bassett ends up fucking letting him in her ambulance at the end and making out with him at the New Year's Eve party. Like, girl, you can do better. Like, why are you waiting around for this ex-cop memory junkie dude who's just obsessed with Juliette Lewis? Like, come on, you can't. Also, if it's a contest between Angela Bassett and Juliette Lewis, I'm sorry, Juliette. You don't stand a chance.
No.
Why was this even a question? Over and over again, she puts herself in direct peril to protect this guy while her child is at home.
Right.
And I don't think that Lenny is the stepdad that she's waiting for. I can't say he's at a place in life
certainly
at the end
not
of the
in
movie
his current state,
where he's
no.
going to step up and, you know, come home, help with the rent, and make everybody's credit better. I don't think that's coming. It's just that it for me that I'm hoping that's the Cameron side of the plot, because what, like, it just does fall apart for me. Like, the strength, I can't remember her goddamn name.
Mace.
Thank you. Yeah. The strength of Mace's character through the film is really betrayed by her weakness for
Lenny. Yeah,
this dude who doesn't shower and puts on half a bicycle helmet to watch himself fuck his ex-girlfriend. Like, dude.
Constantly. He has oversized shoebox full of those tapes.
The first time they meet, Lenny is deliberately manipulative and pushing, like, the boundaries of appropriateness for what it's okay to ask a friend to do. He's just a total dick to her right away.
Yes.
But no, sure. Okay, yeah. You're going to go ahead and get beaten by the cops for this guy.
I think
she gets beaten by the cops to try to do the right thing.
Not for Lenny.
I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. Yeah. I also think that your opening statement, which is, I think, very true, there's no heroes in this movie.
True.
That is the landscape that she's dealing with. If everyone is corrupt, can't she do better? You're probably right. But I'm just saying that the tone of the movie...
That's the scene I want. That's the scene I wish existed in this movie, is Mace kicks him out of the car and drives the fuck away.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the movie, Lenny has to figure out his bullshit on his goddamn own. And then when he's done, he can go knock on her door.
That was...
And the end of the movie can be him like, hey, I was kind of a dick for a long time, but I know you love me and I love you. How about you don't put Mace in peril through the whole movie?
Yeah.
She just kicks you out, drives away.
He's not a great guy. Does a good thing, but
does
doesn't excuse
thing.
Anything.
Does a good thing. He gives her the tape.
Yeah.
After she says, you can't trade this for this lady.
Yeah,
this thing
yeah.
is more important than any of us. And he gives it to her.
Yeah, he has to think about it.
He does.
He wanders away and then finds her again in the crowd.
She's an anti-hero.
He's a piece of
shit. He's an anti-hero.
And she gets beaten by the cops for the tape, not for Lenny, for what she believes is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I think that's true, and that is
But she wouldn't have been in that situation were it not for his unshowered
Absolutely
ass.
Not. And that leaves the question, without Mace there, would Lenny have done the right thing or just tried
Probably
to trade
not.
The tape and get both he and Faith killed?
Probably not, yeah. It's,
I, don't
a,
I
don't
know.
I
think there's that one scene where he literally vomits.
Yeah.
When he witnesses the tape.
When are you talking about the cop
scene?
No,
he sees when he sees Iris's murders when he vomits.
Yeah,
he doesn't vomit.
I don't know. I guess
tape.
That's like the foundation. Like, that's the save the cat moment. And for people who don't know that, that's just like a famous book in Hollywood that's like, how do you make, in your first 10 minutes, you make your main character save a cat. Why? Because that's it's just unfathomably good. So now you're on their side. So to me, that's his save the cat moment, is that he's reacting as any human ought to.
He has a human reaction.
Yeah, and so, like,
it, yeah.
I think that he would react accordingly.
But... Blunt hammer from the start. I don't sell any disc where someone died. No, right, I'm Lenny. I don't deal in death discs. Not Lenny. Nope, I never do the death discs, and I wear a tie. And then the whole movie is just every 10 minutes finding a way for him to say, no, I don't sell anything with anybody dead on it. And also, have you seen my tie?
It's true.
And I will say, they pay it off, but boy, do they mention that tie a lot.
They do mention that tie a lot. That is a Chekhov, that's Chekhov's tie.
Did I mention no death tapes? Pro tie. Did I mention that?
It's 10 minutes ago? Okay. It's that famous trope in Hollywood where it's plant.
Yeah.
Plant. Payoff.
Yeah, but all they grew was a field of corn, like that they could have sold, like Interstellar, because they're just growing one boring crop. It's not like they got an apple tree in the backyard. They are growing one boring crop. Tie, and I don't sell death tapes.
I have fields of ties.
Yes.
Yeah, that is a blunt Cameron decision. I will say that every character that watches the tape does have the same reaction.
Yes.
So she does present a world where this is not okay.
Right.
This is not
except
an okay thing.
It's also the same world where there is a direct market for it.
Sure.
This is a supply and demand type thing where obviously people want to watch this. So there's somebody who does deal in death tapes. Sure, Lenny doesn't.
That's true. Yeah.
But there is a market for this.
What he says implies that I don't sell it.
Other people do.
I do not.
Well, let's talk about scenes that were not filmed but should have been in a segment we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed.
I want to see the scene that explains how in the hell Iris got from an abandoned train yard to a subway in downtown Los Angeles with two racist murder cops chasing her.
There's a lot of yada, yada, yada.
At the end of the party,
Mace is like, how are we going to get into the most oversold party of the century? And then they just walk inside.
Well, and he makes a big deal of it. It's like, trust me, this is what I do.
I got it.
And then they see it.
And then they just walk in behind a caterer. So great. Yeah. I love it.
I also love how Hollywood gets like kind of a buy, like a, you know, it's fine. There's so many times in the sequence or lack thereof that like the murder cops should be able to kill her.
Oh yeah.
But they just cut away.
Yeah.
Like it's just
I want to see the scene where the two murder cops who are played by Vincent D'Onofrio and William Fichtner. I want to see the scene where they get married in secret. Wearing their KKK robes because they're clearly very invested in each other,
they
much more so
are.
Than like a partner relationship. Yeah. Like D'Onofrio freaks out when Fichtner shoots himself.
Yeah,
much more than I think you would if it was just your partner in crime shooting himself. Yeah, so I want to see this because they're like those two spent a lot of time together.
They did.
Yeah, they're best buds.
They are super BFFs at the very least. Like. They are just partners in racist murder and everything else.
Let's make some arguments about the movie that may ruin or improve it in our segment. Let's overthink it.
Okay, so the legality of squid technology is kind of very vague in this movie. Like, it's a black market thing, and then when Angela Bassett takes the tape to the chief of the commissioner of police, he's like, "That's an illegal device." So I guess it's illegal. So, like YouTube and, like, Twitch and, like, streaming would be fucking illegal as shit in this culture. Like, anybody wearing their GoPro cameras, bicycling around, illegal. That video where that guy's wearing his GoPro, you know, like, on a motorcycle at a stop sign, looks over and there's Shia LaBeouf, my favorite video on the internet. Illegal in this future. You can't record what you're doing, like, personally. Like, that is unacceptable.
Right.
And this imagined version of 1999.
That's interesting and weird. I wonder if it's like the sale of it. Like if there's some, maybe it is like, you know, isn't it against terms of, well, I don't know. Like
Are the mini discs illegal?
I don't know.
Is it the mini disc that is illegal in 1999? Was it banned for being so stupid?
Yeah. I had a mini disc player.
Which, by the way, it was a like retrofitted Sony mini disc.
I think Sony was the only one that produced it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like
one
saying
of their,
like,
one of their gambits
Sony,
that didn't pay
illegal.
Off. I also want to know Max, Tom Sizemore's character, who Bigelow must have just loved so much in his 3 seconds in Point Break. She was like, you know what? You're going to be a major supporting character. He falls like 30 stories onto a news van in the middle of a New Year's Eve party with like 10,000 people. Party continues.
Oh, that party continues in spite of a lot. That's
D'Onofrio
the bonus scene
like
I want.
Six people in the back while he's chasing Angela Bassett. Party continues.
End of days.
That's my next bonus scene. It's just two kids high as balls on ecstasy, just turning their heads slightly to watch Tom Sizemore crash from 30 stories above into a news van, and then just turning around like, is Aphex Twin on yet? Yeah. And then just walking to the concert
stage. I think it's more like they look over and then they go, woo!
Y2K!
Y2K, baby! yeah, that party does not give a fuck.
No,
it doesn't.
So we like on this podcast every time we conclude with
every
month now is what we're gonna do. We like to talk about the films that we talked about this month and whether or not one of the movies should go on the gold record that we send into space. Is it canonized?
Mm-hmm.
So the big question is, do we send this movie to aliens? And just to recap, this month we've taken a look at Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty, Point Break, or as today, Strange Days. Which made the biggest impact? Which one do we send to space?
Which one do we send to aliens?
Yeah.
With a Carl Sagan quote and a box of Earth chocolate.
I'll honestly start off and I'm going to go with Point Break.
You think Point Break?
I think Point Break. I think it's the most seminal of all of her films. It's the one that probably has done the best. Arguably Zero Dark Thirty because it's, you know, Oscar fame. But it's the cult hit to me. So there's even a podcast, or not a podcast, sorry, there's the Point Break Live. Like, it is, for some reason, culture has said, we love this film, and I want that to be remembered.
I don't know.
That's a tough one.
I don't know. I don't know if you can put any one of these four movies onto the gold record without, like, an addendum. Like, you need... like, to attach several Wikipedia articles to go along with. Like, context matters for her films. Like,
super does, yeah.
You know, the Hurt Locker, not for Point Break, but yeah. I mean...
Point Break exists free of context.
it's just,
as
it
long as you send
is.
An article on, like, hyperbole and satire along with it.
Right.
I guess that's, I don't know which one of these movies you send out. You need to send a tiny little film critic on the record to be like, well, hang on, just a couple important points about perspective and context.
Like on the Disney DVDs when Leonard Maltin comes up to tell you why this Disney cartoon is so racist.
Or like,
now, before this cartoon begins, let me explain to you why it's racist as fuck.
Or just, like, you're talking about, like, Clippy from Microsoft Word.
But I don't know. In 2017, I'm going to give it to Strange Days.
This is the days.
Yeah, these are weird times, and they've been weird for a long time.
They are strange
days.
It's
relevant days.
Yeah.
I would send Strange Days. I think it's, yeah. I think
Strange Days has it.
Yeah.
Hey. I agree, it's very salient picture.
It gives a pretty, it's definitely like, this is kind of what we're still trying to figure out, so... if you have any thoughts, maybe land, but otherwise you probably want to pass this planet right
it's
on
by. It's true for all four movies, though. Like, here's how
that's
we take
true,
some
yeah.
of our best and brightest and damage them with unjust violence. That happens twice. Here's chaos and crime and trying to find your place in two kinds of worlds that are both fucked up. Welcome to Point Break.
They are very, they're very textual.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, this is what it is. This is the thing, and it's neutral. And here is what we all decide happens when we're thrown into it.
I know we're wrapping up and I know this is really long, but part of what I really love about Kathryn Brigalow movies and why I'm glad that we got to do this week and it's part of this month, her movies are weirdly great and terrible at the same time. There's really good criticism of them that is accurate, and a fine film should be able to tolerate criticism.
Absolutely,
I mean, you can make a really great movie that people can say absolutely accurately terrible things about. Mm. She's challenging. I think... I've never watched a movie of hers that didn't make me scratch my head, but I've also never watched a movie of hers and didn't make the noise at least once.
Yeah, exactly.
It's impressive. She does a lot. She's great at spectacle. She's her vision's pretty broad, and I'm impressed at how well she rises to it. This was a weird movie I had never seen. 14 when it came out, it just missed my radar, and I'm glad to revisit it now. And I don't think if you asked somebody who just pops in movies occasionally, like, hey, who do you think directed Point Break? Like, I just don't think a woman is going to come up first. I think we have this idea of the kind of movie women make.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Kathryn Bigelow has spent
a
decades-long career being like, what?
Not a single
not
film
a single
in her
one.
filmography.
Yeah, not,
you,
that is
maybe
not
Blue
the
Steel,
way I think.
But like, not...
Yeah, not even that, though.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing, is like the idea that we have the idea that what's the type of film a woman would make is like a very...
James Cameron made it. Yeah. Like, he made Titanic. Like, it's those two are just fascinating figures to look at.
Right.
Because, yeah, if you would... Titanic doesn't have that touch of, like, an action director. Like, it's just a weird... He's obsessed with simple romance, and he is obsessed with broad strokes. Mm-hmm. And then you have this counterbalance of Bigelow, who takes tiny moments and explodes them, and is so much darker and grittier and much more interested in character.
Yeah.
Character drives her stories more than stories do. Cameron is a storyteller. Which, big, splash. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's different.
Set and piece, yeah.
I think
much more interested in duality, which we saw in this movie between Lenny and Mace, and then obviously in Point Break between Bodhi and Johnny Utah. Yeah, it's, she likes complex characters.
Yeah.
So we're done here. But we want to...
We are done!
I've declared it... We want to talk about how you can talk to us, so check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @CrackedMoviePod. Please hit us up with your thoughts and suggestions. We've been Abe, Tom, and Caitlin. Caitlin, where can we find you online?
At RobotCaitlin on Twitter or www.CaitlinGillComedy.com. And I swear to God, before this comes out, I'll update my live performance calendar.
Yeah. Anything else you want to plug?
Plugs. You plug things into them and they charge your devices. Plugs
you
are pretty
heard
great.
It here first. Plugs are great. A plug for plugs. We've been honored that you've joined us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I'm always happy. Thank you to join anything cracked. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
It was a blast. October will be John Carpenter month.
Yeah.
Spooky.
Ooh.
And did we talk about what the first one is? I want to say
I think
Escape.
It's going to be Escape from New York. Yeah.
So,
not really a spooky film, but you can't talk about John Carpenter without talking about it.
Right. So next week we'll start with 1981's Escape from New York. Listeners, please tweet or Facebook message us about what directors you want us to cover, because we're listening. That's it. Watch on, movie people.
Hey everyone, Scott Aukerman here, and I am here to tell you why, if you love podcasts, and it sounds like you're listening to one right now, I bet that you're going to love a little show that I host on Earwolf called Comedy Bang Bang. Comedy Bang Bang is the show, there's no better way to describe it than as the show where I talk to interesting people. Doesn't that sound great? Some of those interesting people just this year that we've had on include Tig Notaro, Andy Samberg, Kumail Nanjiani, John Hamm, Rachel Bloom, so many more, and we have some amazing guests coming this fall that I can't even mention yet. And then stick around after my first interview, because you never know what other entertaining people or interesting people just might show up. There has never been a better time to start listening to Comedy Bang Bang. Check it out on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.